Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. I'm Rachel Isaacs, a student from Manalapan, New Jersey, and the engineer for this program. We look forward to learning some Torah with you today. Thank you for tuning in. Today we are joined by Rabbi Meir Schweiger, a faculty member and the Mashgiach Ruchani, or spiritual guide, at Pardes. He will be teaching us about Parshat Behalotecha. A few quick announcements, and then we'll hand it over to Rabbi Schweiger. Your participation and feedback is vital for the success of the podcast series. Please send us comments on the episode, where you live, and how you heard about us. Send your email to podcast@pardesusa.org. Thank you. That's it. And now Rabbi Schweiger.
Thank you, Rachel. This week's parsha, Parshat Behalotecha, marks a stark transition for the Jewish people. And I would like to begin with the introduction to the book of Numbers in the commentary of the Netziv, Rabbi Yehuda Naftali Tzvi Berlin, who in his commentary, Ha'amek Davar, tries to always give an introduction to each book and somehow give you the essence of what the book is all about. And the book of Numbers, he describes as being the book where the Jews make the transition from the generation that left Egypt to the generation that's to enter the land of Israel. But perhaps more important, it's a reflection of a movement from a reality in which God is performing miracles, where the Jews experience God in a supernatural way, to a reality where God is very much in the background. And this transition, or the beginning of that transition, occurs in this week's parsha. And let me elaborate. The first 10 chapters of the book of Numbers deal with the organization of the Jewish people in preparation for their entry into the land of Israel. There are a number of censuses which are taken, one of the general Jewish population, two of the Levites. There is the organization of the people in terms of their place around the tabernacle. There are groupings of three tribes called digalim, banners, where each banner is put in a different direction. In the beginning of this week's parsha, there is the taking of the Levi'im in chapter 8 for the purpose of their installation for their role. And it seems that everything is put in place without going into all the details, so that the Jewish people should be able to enter the land of Israel. But not just to enter the land of Israel, but in the words of the Netziv, to enter the land of Israel as the chariot of God. And in fact, if we look in our parsha, in chapter 10, verse 33, it says, Vayis'u mehar Hashem, and they journeyed from the mountain of Hashem, derech shloshet yamim, a path of 3 days, va'arom brit Hashem nosea lefneihem, and the ark of the covenant of God journeys before them, derech shloshet yamim, the 3-day path, Latur lahem minucha, to spy out for them a resting place. In the next verse, Va'anan Hashem aleihem, and the cloud of God is upon them, yomam, by day, benos'am min hamachaneh, when they journey from the camp. According to many commentaries, this verse is outlining a scenario of how the Jews were supposed to travel or make the transition from being in the desert to coming into the land of Israel. The ark is supposed to travel before them. The cloud is upon them. The ark is, if you want to use modern terminology, the interference. And in fact, if we look in the next two verses, which are familiar to many people, it says, Vayhi ben Saharon, and when the ark journeyed, Vayomer Moshe, Moshe said, Kuma Hashem, arise God, V'yafutzu Ayvecha, and may your enemies be dispersed, V'yanusu Misanecha Mipanecha, and may those who hate you flee from before you. I think many people are not necessarily aware of what the full ramifications of this verse are, which is recited every Shabbat. What this verse is saying is that when the ark is traveling before the Jews, the ark is supposed to be this overwhelming presence which will terrify the inhabitants of the land of Israel so that they will flee before the Jewish people. And in fact, according to a number of commentaries, Sforno, for example, an Italian commentary from the 1500s, who says in the beginning of the book of Bamidbar that the Jews should have entered the land of Israel without having to wage war. Their entry in the land was supposed to be miraculous. The ark was supposed to go before them and terrify all of the inhabitants so that they would flee. And therefore, if I come back to how I began this session, everything has been set up in the first 10 chapters of Bamidbar so that the Jews should now enter the land in a very majestic manner, in a manner which is not only awe-inspiring, but even perhaps terrifying, so that the inhabitants of the land will be overwhelmed by the presence of God and, in effect, make room so that the Jewish people should now be able to take possession of the land. This is an ideal description of how the land should be possessed by the Jewish people without the necessity to wage war. I'd like to interject now. In this scenario, Moses would have been the one to bring the Jewish people into the land of Israel, and perhaps Moses would have been the Messiah. And this may have meant the end, in a certain way, of Jewish history. Because basically, this would have brought in the era, the Messianic era. Yet what we find from chapter 11 on, in rapid succession, a series of stories, one after the other, where the Jewish people are sinning. And where somehow the Jewish people show that they are either not interested or not capable of entering in this majestic way, so that in next week's parsha, when the Jewish people send the spies, they're told by God that a whole generation will die in the desert and that it will take 40 years until the Jewish people finally enter the land of Israel. And when they enter the land of Israel, it will be under different terms. God will be in the background. There will be the need to wage war. What I'd like to look at is this process of how the Jews somehow lose this reality, the reality of the desert, the reality of a supernatural divine guidance, and have to experience a reality where they need to take much more initiative, where God is very much in the background. I'd like to begin by going back to a verse which I mentioned earlier, which is chapter 10, verse 33. It says, "Vayis'u mehar Hashem derech shloshet yamim," and they journeyed from the mountain of God a path of 3 days. There's a very interesting midrashic comment which Nachmanides quotes, which is relating to a problem in the text. Why say "Vayis'u mehar Hashem"? Why say they journey from the mountain of God? Previously, we've seen the area where the Jews are as being Sinai, Sinai Desert. And that would have been the most appropriate way of describing their journey. The Jews are now journeying from the Sinai Desert. Alternatively, it could have said where the Jews are journeying towards. Why emphasize the journey from the mountain of God? And the answer given in a midrash is kitinok haboreach mi beta sefer. That this is trying to highlight that when the Jews leave the mountain of God, it is like a little kid who runs away from school. And Nachmanides says that this comment sets the stage for all of the succeeding stories. The problem of the Jewish people begins with an attitude. The attitude that leaving Mount Sinai is not something that I do with a heavy heart, because there was this unbelievable experience which they had there. Because Mount Sinai is very much connected with that intimate relationship between the Jewish people and God. Rather, the Jewish people, for them, it is in a way a relief to leave Sinai. With the example being a little kid who finds that school is a tremendous burden, who, as is the case of children, want to have fun, want to play, don't want to necessarily be sitting in a classroom all the time, do not want to be forced to sit and learn. It's boring. It's demanding. And that sets the stage for what follows. According to this midrash, the Jewish people somehow have difficulty with the idea of taking responsibility, the idea of a close, intimate relationship with God, which on a certain level is mind-boggling, but on another level is extremely demanding. And from the beginning, it seems that the Jews find the demanding element to be overwhelming. So that the moment that they're given the opportunity, there's this sense of relief, release. Great, we don't have to be at the mountain anymore. So God isn't gonna pour on us more laws, more demands. Maybe God will loosen up. It's very striking that this is a midrash, which some people would say is reading a lot into the verse. And even for somebody who would embrace the midrash, it's clear that this is certainly not explicit in the text. But sometimes there are different elements of a person's behavior which are not apparent, or maybe apparent in a very, very subtle way, where there are problems. And where all of a sudden, when it snowballs, somebody could say, but how did this happen? But if you would look back a little bit, you'd be able to see, well, it didn't just happen. It's part of a process. And sometimes it's important to be able to notice the process at the very beginning to somehow be able to check it. And in this case, the beginning of the process is an attitude. What a relief to leave Mount Sinai. When we continue on to chapter 11, verse 1, the verse says, Vayhi ha'am kimit onanim, ra ba'oznei Hashem. And the people were, and I'll translate this, as complainers, as grievers, evil in the ears of God. Vayishma Hashem, and God heard, Vayichar apo, he is angry, Vativar bam eish Hashem, and the fire of God consumes them, Vatochal, and it eats, B'kzeh ha-machaneh, at the edge of the camp. It's clear from the end of the verse that there's something going on over here which is very, very problematic. God is angry. Instant punishment. Maybe I should point out that when it says at the end of the verse, Vatochal b'kzeh ha-machaneh, that God consumes, eats in the edge of the camp, the sense of the commentaries, which is already brought down in Rashi, is that we're not talking about a phenomenon which necessarily is a mass phenomenon. It might be that this is something which is the periphery, tzei ha-machaneh, the edge of the camp. And in fact, it's interesting, there are two different interpretations. One says, this is referring to what we would call the riffraff. And another interpretation says maybe k'tzei means the k'tzinim, the officers of the camp. Personally, my inclination is that we're not talking about the officers. We're perhaps talking about a fringe element in the camp. A fringe element which maybe is unhappy, and which is beginning to perhaps be this sore that's festering. But what exactly is going on over here? It says, Vayhi ha'am kimit onanim. Whenever the Torah refers to the Jewish people as an am, am usually has to do with the idea of the mass of people. Very often in rabbinic literature, the word am is seen as a pejorative description of the Jewish people. It's not the Jewish people at their finest, which certainly would be appropriate over here. What are the people doing? It says, kimit onanim. I would like to bring up two interpretations of what this word kimit onanim means. Ramban, in his commentary, says that the word mit'onenim has to do with the word onen, which is the term for someone, a mourner, but not a mourner, technically, the period between burial and death. Someone who's in a period of intense grief. And he relates it to the word onen, which has to do with the idea of in pain. People who are in pain. It's very interesting that the word mit'onanim is reflexive, which means it's as if the people are creating their pain. Kim mit'onanim, like those. And therefore, what Nachmanides says is that the people now are in pain. They're grieving, they're complaining. One might even say they're bemoaning their fate. But one of the things which Nachmanides says is there's what we might call the objective reality, and then there's the subjective perception. And it's always very interesting, you know, when you have a cup which is half full. Do you see the side which is half full or the side which is half empty? The Jews are now beginning their journey. One could look at this and be ecstatic, be happy, because the Jews could say to themselves, here we are. We're on this journey which is eventually going to bring us to our permanent homes. We're on a journey where we have the cloud and we have the fire and we have the ark before us. Where God is providing, we have the manna, we have the water that's accompanying us. And where the Jews could come along and say that, here we are. God has set up everything for us. Very soon we will enter the land. Very soon we will come to our permanent homes. And there could be an attitude which is very uplifting, which is very excited about this new prospect. On the other hand, you could also have an attitude which focuses and harps on the difficulties. Here we are, we're traveling, it's a desert. It could be that we're traveling a few days. It could be that in the interim, in the short term, it's very, very demanding. It's very, very challenging. And as much as God is providing for them, but God is also pushing them. And therefore, it's very easy for people to also focus on the negative things and to be able to say, we're hot and we're tired and we're hungry. And here we are, we're following God and we have to go by God's beat. And we can't stop when we want to. We stop when God tells us. And therefore, this can create a sense of frustration, of pain, bitterness. And this is how the Ramban understands mitonanim. The people are very much bemoaning the fact that here they are. They're traveling. It's very, very difficult. Why do we have to do this? But it's interesting, it says, Ra bo'oznei Hashem. This is not something where the people are up in arms and are shouting to Moshe and are complaining. It's something which is murmuring under their breath. Perhaps it's not even murmuring. Perhaps it's something which is, well, it would be a little bit more than just what they're thinking. But it's something which God hears. It's not something which is audible to everyone. And it may only be a segment of the population that's doing this. But God is angry, and God responds immediately. And the fire which accompanies the Jewish people, which perhaps should be directed against their enemies, is now being directed against them. The fire very often is a symbol for the attribute of God's justice. In fact, instant punishment. This appears also in Leviticus in chapter 10, in the story of Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron. So that we have the Jews who, according to a midrash cited earlier, leave Mount Sinai like a little kid who's running away from school, who then take it one step further as they begin traveling, start bemoaning their fate, start complaining to themselves, or at least thinking to themselves, how difficult it is. To the credit of the Jews, in chapter 11, verse 2, it says, Vayitzak ha'am el Moshe, the people cry out to Moshe, Vayitpalel Moshe el Hashem, and Moshe then prays to God. Which means that the people don't start a whole revolt. But when the people cry out, crying out usually is an expression for crying out for help. They turn to Moshe to somehow help them. Moshe prays to God, and immediately the fire subsides. But then we come to the next story, which is the bulk of chapter 11. And I would just like to focus on a few verses, and we'll end with that today. It says in chapter 11, verse 4, V'hasafsuf asher b'kirbo, and the riffraff, mixed multitude that's in their midst, hit'avu ta'ava, desired, a desire. Vayashuvu, and they return, vayivku, and they cry, gam b'nei Israel, also the children of Israel. Vayomru, and they say, mi ya'achilenu basar, who will give us meat? Zacharnu tadaga, we remember the fish, asher nochal b'mitzrayim chinam, which we ate in Egypt for free, etakishuim, the squash, etavatichim, the watermelons, etachatzir, the leeks, etabitzalim, the onions, etashumim, and the garlic. And now verse 6, vata, and now, nafshenu yevesha, our souls are dry, ein kol, and I'll leave the translation for a moment, bilti el haman einenu, only to the man do our eyes look. And the next verse goes on to say, Vahaman, but the man, Kizra Gadhu, was like coriander seed. Ve'eno ke'en abdolach, and it appears like crystal. Shatu ha'am, the people would spread themselves out, v'laktu, and gather, v'tachanu b'raychaim, and grind it in a mill, odachu b'amdocha, or grind it up in a press, uvishlu b'parur, and they would cook it with a spoon, a cooking spoon, v'asu oto ugot, and make it into cakes, v'haya tamo, and its taste was ketam l'shad hashamen, like something, and I'll just translate, something which is very, very oily. Uvered tatalam ala machane laila, and when the dew would go on the camp at night, yered haman alav, the man would go upon it. And one more verse. Vayishma Moshe et ha'am, Moshe heard the people, bochel l'mishpachotav, crying to their families, ish l'fetach alo, a man at the entrance of his tent. Vayicharaf Hashem ma'od, and God became very angry, uve'enei Moshe ra, and in the eyes of Moshe, it was also evil. If we look at the last verse that I just read, it seems that this time around, we're not talking about something which people are thinking, maybe murmurings under their breath. We're now talking about people who are crying, lemishpachotav, and the way this is understood, by their families, crying as groups. Ish lefetach olo, people who are crying at the entrance to their tent. We're now talking about something which is a mass phenomenon, which is out in the open. To the point where Moshe hears them crying. It isn't just God who hears. To the point where it's not only God getting angry, but God getting very angry. And even in the eyes of Moshe, this is something which is very, very evil. Well, what's bothering the people? It's very interesting. The people in verse 4 say, we want meat. Okay? And it's clear from the continuation that somehow the people are not satisfied, are not happy with the fact that they have manna. They want more. They want meat. It's interesting that the people all of a sudden start talking about how they remember in verse 5 what they had in Egypt. It's interesting, in verse 5, they don't talk about the fact that they had meat. They remember they had fish. They remember had this whole variety of vegetables, which then begs the question, so then what is it that the people really want? Do they want meat? Do they want what they had in Egypt? I would like to now present two things. And that's connected with verse 6. It would seem to be that the most basic thing which is bothering the people is the fact that they have man. Because they say, all that we have, bilti el haman einenu, Our eyes are only on this man. It seems that that's what's driving them crazy. Man every day. They can't take it. They'd like something else. And therefore, it makes sense that even though they say we want meat, but it might be that it's not only meat. It could very well be that they say, we remember we had fish and we had all these different types of vegetables. So that give me anything, but don't give me man. So that on one level, one could very well say that the man which they get every day, they're just bored of. The same old food. On the other hand, if you look at the beginning of verse 6, it seems there may be something else. It says, Vata, and now Nafshenu Yevesha, our souls are dry, ain kol. We have nothing. Kol means nothing. Well, you say to yourself, but what do you mean you have nothing? In the very next thing, they say, we have the manna. So the simplest way is to say, well, as far as we're concerned, the manna is nothing. There's another way you could read the phrase, ein kol, as we don't have everything. Which means, if we don't have everything, we have nothing. And maybe that reflects a certain attitude of the people. And now I want to go back to verse 5. It says the people had a desire. It seems to be that this is the problem. People who have desires fantasize and perhaps can never be fully satisfied because there's always something which they don't have. And very often, if I don't have everything, I have nothing. And even if what I have is unbelievable, and now I want to look at it, if you look at verse 8, you'll see how the Torah describes how the manna could be everything to the people. And in fact, according to the rabbinic understanding, you can make the manna into whatever you want it to be. It would be the ancient equivalent of tofu. You can eat it raw, you can cook it, you can bake it, you can roast it, you can mix it with other things, and it will have the taste and maybe even the appearance of whatever your heart desires. But at rock bottom, it's manna. But in order to be those different things, perhaps you also have to work for it. You have to cook it. You have to bake it. You have to be creative. I always like to give the analogy. Give a kid a piece of paper and crayons. There are limitless possibilities to what you can do with that. You can make unbelievable drawings. There's no end to what you can do. There's no end to the creativity which should come out. But unfortunately, I've heard in my experience as a parent very often, after a little while, I'm bored. Well, why is this boring? Is it boring because objectively it's boring? Or is it boring because maybe you're boring? Because you're not prepared to challenge yourself and to now utilize what you have and make the most of it where the most is limitless. And perhaps you can already see this in the expression in verse 6, Ata nafshenu yevesha, our souls are dry, and maybe that's the problem. The problem is not with the man. The problem is with the people whose souls are dry, who are not prepared to now work with what they have and maximize it, but want to be constantly entertained and given things and readily get bored so that every time, well, what else can you do for me? And that's the problem of ta'ava. There's an interesting parallel between this story and the Garden of Eden. God places Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and gives them to eat of all the trees of the garden, all the trees, except one. One tree, the tree of knowledge, they cannot eat of. And it's that one tree, if you look in chapter 3 in Genesis, which the woman looks at and desires. And the feeling that if I don't have that one tree, I don't have anything. Because it's all or nothing. Deja vu. The people are now repeating the error of the Garden of Eden. An error which is rooted in desire. Desire which is, I want to be able to have everything, and if I don't have everything, I have nothing. An attitude which is always looking at what I don't have rather than what I do have. And as I mentioned earlier in the mitonanim, it began with the mitonanim. Do you look at the half cup which is full, or do you look at the half cup which is empty? What the Jews are showing here, unfortunately, is a very typical human trait. A human trait which very often tends to look at what I don't have, to always accentuate the negative, and to find it very difficult to appreciate and value the positive. And very often what happens is you lose the positive that you have. And it's only once you've lost it that all of a sudden you begin to value it and appreciate it, but at that point it's too late. This, unfortunately, is the story of the Jews in the desert. And this is a story that very often repeats itself, both on an individual and on a national level. Perhaps our job is to be able to learn from this story, to be able to learn how to value what we have, to be able to maximize it, to be able to not fantasize and always imagine what could be, but to appreciate what is. And perhaps even more so, where what is something which is a gift from God, to be able to thank God every moment for that which we have. With that type of attitude, we can bring about the redemption. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Please tell your friends about this podcast series, and please let us know your thoughts and comments. Send us email via podcast@pardesusa.org. Thanks to Dr. David Bernstein, who is the executive producer of the Pardes from Jerusalem podcast series. Shalom and goodbye from Jerusalem.